Here on Radio 4 FM, the book of the week, Far From the Tree by Andrew Solomon, documents the repeated triumphs of human love and compassion to show that the shared experience of difference is what unites us. In today's episode, he considers the choices people make when they decide to have a child. The reader is Kerry Shale.
I walk in the rain by your side. I'll cling to the warmth of your tiny hand. I'll do anything to help you understand. I'll love you more than anybody can.
The right to reproduce should be among the inalienable ones. Yet the prejudice against anomalous people is revealed most clearly when a disabled or challenged adult produces a disabled or challenged child. Newscaster and actress Bree Walker was born with ectrodactyly, or lobster claw syndrome, which results in deformities of the hands and feet. She bore a child with the syndrome, and when she became pregnant again in 1990, she knew that her second child might also inherit the condition. She chose to keep the pregnancy and became the fodder of outrage. Walker said, "It was shocking to me that anyone would make such negative public assumptions about an unborn child and his ability to cope with the world, regardless of the shape of his hands or feet." Implicit in many of the criticisms was that Walker had had no right to get pregnant, even that she was morally obliged to abort, no matter how much she wanted her child or how competent she was to raise it. The media condemnation largely failed to acknowledge that veterans of a condition their children may inherit are uniquely qualified to understand the risks and rewards of life with that condition. Their choices are better informed than our judgments of them. Sharon Duchesneau and Candace McCulloch, lesbian deaf women, wanted a child, and in 2002, they asked a friend who was fifth-generation deaf to be their sperm donor. They produced two deaf children. They decided to share their experience with a reporter from the Washington Post, fomenting an onslaught of attacks much like those on Bree Walker. Few people would assert that a deaf married couple should not procreate because of the risk of producing deaf children. Some would stipulate that the line be drawn between what one accepts and what one seeks, arguing that the deaf children of heterosexual deaf parents occur by natural process. But love and rules do not mix well, and the concept of natural is itself a constantly shifting, unnatural idea, often used to veneer prejudice. Sharon said, "It would be nice to have a child who is the same as us." Candy said, "I want to be the same as my child. I want the baby to enjoy what we enjoy." These don't seem like radical statements until you learn they came from deaf people. I began work on this book at about the same time I met John, who is now my husband. I had always wanted children, but the possibility had lingered in abstraction. I had been unpopular as a child, and children continued to intimidate me. I felt that, in their eyes, I was still bad at dodgeball, with a funny gait and emotionally gauche, that I had retained all the qualities that had made children shun me in my own childhood, qualities I had eventually understood to be aligned with my sexuality. I was still afraid of being called gay by children. My secure identity resonated like an insult when spoken by a child. I was usually relieved to leave other people's children after a few hours. Would I feel otherwise if I had my own? John already had a biological son when I met him. He and the child's biological mother, Laura, had been co-workers, and Laura had observed him for years before she and her partner, Tammy, asked him to help them have a child. Though not especially close to them, he had agreed, and they signed legal documents in which he forswore paternal rights, and they forswore claims to support. He had offered to be in the child's life to the extent he was able, if the child and his mother's so wished, but in deference to Tammy's position as adoptive mother, he had remained largely uninvolved. He didn't immediately make a point of introducing me to Tammy and Laura, but a few months after our relationship began, we ran into them, with their toddler, Oliver. Oliver, unable to comprehend donor dad, called John Donut Dad, which made everybody laugh. But then, who was I? 18 months later, they asked John to be their donor again, and Laura subsequently gave birth to Lucy. I was wary of John's connection to this family, and also fascinated. In 1999, during a business trip to Texas, I attended a dinner that included my college friend, Blaine. Blaine had always been magical to me, reflexively kind, with an acute intelligence that she never shows off, and possessed of timeless grace. She had recently divorced, and shortly thereafter lost her mother, and she mentioned that the best tribute she could pay to her happy childhood was to become a mother herself. I said, in a light-hearted way, at a table full of other people, that I'd be game to be the father to her child. She countered brightly that she might just take me up on the offer. 4 years later, Blaine flew to New York for my surprise 40th birthday party. We went out to dinner the following night and realized that we both wanted to follow through with the baby project. I had never been so honored or so alarmed. Our arrangements would be similar to John's, with Tammy and Laura in some ways, but different in others. I would be the legal father of a child who would bear my last name. Though our child would live in Texas with Blaine, the relationship would be explicitly paternal. I wasn't ready to tell John right away, and when I did tell him, he exploded, as I feared he might. He had been a sperm donor. I would be in an ongoing, profound relationship with Blaine that he feared might lethally triangulate our own. So began the most difficult epoch of our relationship. We talked about it for months, John and I, Blaine and I, and it took 3 years to iron out the details. But John, whose benevolence always triumphs, finally relented, and Blaine and I created a pregnancy, working through an IVF clinic. Blaine, meanwhile, had met her partner Richard, putting a reasonable, if unusual, balance in place. The more curious our arrangements became, the more traditional they started to feel. John and I tied the knot on the 30th of June 2007 at a wedding in the countryside. Tammy and Laura and their children came. Oliver served as John's ring bearer. Blaine, 4 months pregnant with the child she and I had conceived, came with Richard. And John ventured that we'd had the first gay shotgun wedding. On the 5th of November 2007, I watched the obstetrician pull little Blaine out of the convex surface of her mother's swollen belly and was the first person to hold her. I kept trying on the idea that I was now a father, and I didn't know what to do with it. I held the new baby, Blaine held her, Richard held her, John held her. Who were we all to this thrilling creature? Who was she to all of us? I soon realized that I wanted to bring up a child at home with John to be a pledge between us. John's original arrangement with Tammy and Laura had answered a question. The arrangement with Blaine was more intimate. And the prospect of having a child who would live full-time with the two of us was an explosion of everything we'd been taught to expect from life as gay men. Because John was less sure about wanting this child than I professed to be, I had to act as cheerleader for the enterprise. I was full of hopeful infatuation with a person who did not yet exist, and sure that fatherhood would exalt everything I already cherished about John. Our love for each other was a prerequisite for a child, but not a reason for one. We could not procreate as a social experiment or a political statement, or to make ourselves whole, and I could not be the sole enthusiast in our decision. Then John gave me an antique cradle tied up with a bow for my birthday and said, "If it's a boy, can we call him George, after my grandpa?" We told Laura and Tammy about our plan, and Laura said to John, "We couldn't have had Oliver and Lucy without you, and will never be able to thank you enough for that. But I could be your surrogate, to show you how much you and Andrew mean to us." It was a gesture of spectacular generosity, and we accepted it. The day of George's birth, the 9th of April, 2009, was emotionally charged before it began. I tried to quell my anxiety, but by the time George's head showed, my palms were damp with fear. Seeing Laura give birth, I witnessed the pain of the final dilation and pushing, and felt the radical newness coming out of her. She pushed twice, and out George popped, instantly proving the strength of his lungs with a good cry and wiggling his arms and legs. The obstetrician pronounced him healthy. I am the heavy sleeper in the family, so I slumbered peacefully while John got up every few hours to check on George and feed him. The next morning, the pediatrician came in and said she was concerned. George had not been drawing his legs up the way that babies are supposed to. She wanted to order a CAT scan. I asked whether this was unusual, and she said simply that it didn't frequently occur at this stage. She noted that his head was unusually large, which could be related to hydrocephalus or the presence of tumors. She was young, and I could tell that this was the steady, competent manner she had learned for the purpose of being honest with people. I asked how soon the CAT scan could be done, and the pediatrician said she'd set it up as soon as possible, and, in her brisk and pleasant way, she left the room. We watched helplessly as George was positioned in the machine. They let us stay, wearing big lead aprons, and we tried to comfort George, and I was suddenly aware of how uncomforting I was to someone who had not yet learned to turn to me for comfort. Back in our room, we waited. The on-call pediatrician phoned radiology. The results weren't in, so we waited some more. Finally, I cornered a newly arrived on-call pediatrician. We walked back to the room where John was waiting, and I blurted out sweatily, "Is there bleeding in his brain?" And the pediatrician said, "The scan was completely clear." I understood the day George was declared well that hope is not a thing with feathers, but a squalling pink thing newly arrived, that no other optimism is so great as having a child. It must be easier to lead a life in which you are not constantly inventing all the roles, in which there is a script to follow. Most people expect to have children, and certain susceptibilities are attached to that. I had expected not to have children, and the reversal contains stranger ones. I have said that parents do not reproduce, but create. In fact, we also discover. I sometimes think of my life as 40 years of toil up some steep hill, and then I joined hands with John, and then with Blaine, and then with Tammy and Laura, and in a different way with everyone else chronicled in this volume. Somehow, the lot of us made it to the crest. And when I looked out, I saw all creation spread at my feet. I had no idea, when I was hiking, that this was what I was climbing towards. 40 years in the wilderness has never prepared anyone for this view.
Kerry Shale was reading the final extract from Far From the Tree by Andrew Solomon. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4.
Bureaucracy makes me think of Stalinist Russia.
I think of government, I think of massed ranks of civil servants in bowler hats.
It's usually something that holds you back when you're trying to get things done.
The former Cabinet Secretary, Gus O'Donnell, cuts through the red tape.
Forget everything you think you know about bureaucracy. Bureaucracy is your friend. It nurtures you from cradle to grave.
He discusses the true worth of our civil servants with the head of MI5, Jonathan Evans, and Tony Blair.
If you gave me the choice of any bureaucracy I can think of in the Western world, I'd choose ours.
In Defence of Bureaucracy, on Tuesday morning at 9 on BBC Radio 4.